is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 59 was recorded on April 19th, 2017. I'm Eric Townsend. Noted author Danielle DiMartino Booth is fed up with the Federal Reserve after working inside the Dallas Fed's research department through the great financial crisis and the subsequent accommodative policy decisions. In fact, she's so fed up that she wrote a book by that same name, Fed Up, chronicling the Fed's policy decisions of the last 10 years from an insider's perspective. I think you're really going to enjoy this interview, as Danielle pulls no punches in criticizing the culture and the charter efficacy of her former employer.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, we have to just do a quick review of the markets here. That we've now seen this week twice where the S&P 500 has tried to rally, and each time it seems to be met with active distribution just a half a day into a rally. What's your feeling on the S&P here?
Well, definitely. We took out the 50-day moving average to the downside last week. We had a couple of attempts to get back to it, which both failed this week. So that is, you know, bearish technical signals here. But the bottom's not falling out either. You know, a lot of people were saying, okay, the top is in. If you think about how great bull markets eventually end, it's usually a blow-off top with a sudden, sharp reversal to the downside. That's not happening yet. You know, yeah, we're down, what, 50 points from where we were at the very top on the S&P. So I think that it's long overdue that this bull market should be over. We should see a rollover into a bear market, but we're not seeing any definitive sign that I can see that that's definitely upon us yet. Could be. And that leaves me in the same place that I've been for, at least the last year or so, which is I can't justify being long this market. I don't believe in this rally, but I can't justify being short either because the trend is still up. So I'm on the sidelines.
Well, you know, I just have to add something to that, and I just wanted your opinion on it as well. Obviously, this weekend is coming up, the French elections, and it's really interesting the way things are emerging here. Even just a few weeks ago, it really looked like it was going to be a Le Pen versus Macron kind of finished for the final two. But suddenly, over the last, you know, 2, 3, 4 weeks, we've now had this leftist, this Mélenchon, I believe is if. Hopefully pronouncing it correctly, has been creeping up in the polls. And we now are finding that they're all so close that it's a rounding error. And the analogy that was used was it the equivalent of a Le Pen versus Mélenchon kind of contest would actually be the equivalent of Trump versus Sanders. And I'm wondering whether the market is going to have this moment of uncertainty here in the next few days with this nervousness. And more importantly, if that was the case, how are the 2 weeks in between the April 23rd election and the subsequent May 7th election going to be? I can't see the market blasting off bullishly or even bearishly with all of that uncertainty. What's your thinking there?
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head with the last part of that. It's about that two-week sort of uncertainty zone between the two elections. And I don't know enough about French politics to really have a strong view. But what I would say is we're already seeing some discount in global equity markets that things could get really dicey depending on the outcome of this election. So I think if you had a definitive win where this weekend it's pretty much such a strong win that there's really no question about what's going to happen 2 weeks later, everybody knows the outcome. That's going to be a sigh of relief. On the other hand, if you see more of a, you know, we're not even sure, is it a Le Pen runoff? There's a chance of Le Pen, serious chance of Le Pen taking the victory. I think that that introduces more volatility and more downside potential. But again, that gives you those 2 weeks of uncertainty. If there's a lot of downside potential because it looks like, holy cow, Le Pen really is going to win this thing, and then she doesn't, you're going to see that sigh of relief again. So I don't pretend to know enough about this to be qualified to trade it. I would say we can expect some roller coaster moves over the next couple of weeks.
You know what? Actually, what would be very interesting to see is whether this becomes like a deja vu of the American elections, which is that really that all the volatility was in the weeks prior to the election. And even though Trump won, the market interpreted very bullishly. And I'm wondering whether all of this uncertainty is a build up to that May 7th election. And then whether or not Le Pen wins or not, that the markets will, now that they have certainty, suddenly unwind all of these hedges and suddenly there's this liquidity burst of buying that suddenly drives a new breakout. It'll be very interesting if that kind of deja vu scenario occurs. Nonetheless, I wanted to just quickly move on to the dollar index here, because we have the U.S. dollar index once again meeting a little bit of pressure, falling under that 100 handle. What's your feeling on the U.S. dollar here?
Well, we're resting here on key support around 99. I think that Donald Trump is clearly responsible for jawboning the market lower. His comments sent the dollar dramatically to the downside. Now, Mnuchin claims in an official statement that no, President Trump is not in any way, shape, or form trying to jawbone the dollar lower. I'm not sure what the reality TV quote is to respond to that one, but I think that that's nonsense. Mr. Trump has been very clear in saying that he thinks that the elevated state of the dollar is hurting American business and that we need a lower dollar. So it's going to be interesting. I'm kind of glad that I'm sitting this one out. What's happening is exactly what I feared. You know, I was stopped out of the long trade. We saw a bounce and it sort of felt like, oh no, I got, you know, tripped out right at the bottom. It's all uphill from here. That it seems like this is a dead cat bounce that's now coming back down to retest that key support. And I wouldn't be surprised if we did have a shakeout. There's so much long interest built up in the dollar index that if it all unwinds at once, you know, it's everybody on one side of the boat. You know how that story usually ends. I would comment, though, that the dollar index has a lot more liquidity in it than, you know, if we're talking about everybody is on the long side of pork bellies or something, then, of course, when everybody starts to panic and get out, the price move could be monumental. I don't think you have so much price sensitivity just because there's so much liquidity in the dollar.
All right, but now I want to move on to where I really need to ask you what's going on, and that's with crude oil. You know, everything seemed like it was a pretty calm little movement going into that inventory number, and suddenly the inventories, at least to me, didn't look like they were anything particularly special, and suddenly we find ourselves $2 down, almost touching the bottom end of that 50 handle. What's your feeling here on oil?
Well, for sure, you know, we're seeing exactly the sell-off that I've been predicting for the last couple of weeks. And the way I would characterize it is definitely it happened at the time of the inventory report on Wednesday morning. That was the catalyst. Well, you look at that inventory report, and what we saw was a drawdown of 1 million barrels in crude oil inventory. Of that, 778,000 barrels were from Cushing, Oklahoma. So drawdown in crude, drawdown in Cushing stocks. Well, gee, that should normally be bullish. How come we're getting this bearish reaction? Well, it was offset by an unexpected build in gasoline inventories of 1.5 million barrels. Okay, that's an unexpected sign that could be bearish. But hey, there was a drawdown of 2 million barrels of distillates, and that offsets the gasoline build as far as I'm concerned. Production is up again. Well, duh, that ought to be easy to predict considering what the rig count has been doing. So why is it then that really a kind of middle-of-the-road inventory report that was not super bullish or super bearish, why was that the catalyst for a $2 move to the downside? And I think the answer is the market is finally waking up to reality here and recognizing that, yeah, okay, so we it's seasonally, we ought to be having big drawdowns and drawdown week after week. We saw an itsy-bitsy, teeny-weeny little drawdown this week. Production is still ticking up, and I think really what's happening is the OPEC narrative is breaking down. Now, a listener called me out on Twitter this week and said, hey, what are you talking about? I said last week that OPEC is taking what did not work, that's their 1.8 million barrel per day cut in production, and talking about doing it for 6 more months of what has not worked. And our listener said, hey, dude, I don't know about you, but I trade price, and if OPEC was trying to get the price up, it worked. The price is up by like $6. So what are you talking about? Touche, sir. I stand corrected. You are absolutely correct. The OPEC objective of elevating the price has, in fact, worked. And I misspoke. What I should have said is that it did work, But it's not going to last because it is based entirely on abject, unadulterated bullshit coming from OPEC, saying that, you know, we're going to balance the market and blah, blah, blah. There's no drawdowns that are significant in storage. The market is not rebalanced. That narrative is just nonsense, and it always has been. And frankly, I think it should have been obvious to everybody, but it wasn't. Finally, it seems like that's sinking in, and I think that when we didn't see a really big drawdown, it was just time for the market from a technical standpoint. That $53 level was a key technical level. We tried to test it. I think the bulls were waiting to see what happened with this inventory report, if it was going to be the magic ticket to very bullish data. They didn't get it. And the market's out of steam. So I think it's probably going to be a fast ride back down. From here, we sliced through the 50-day moving average, which is at 51.47 or so. So without even a pause, there wasn't even a two-tick bounce on taking out the 50-day moving average. So from here, the next step probably is 48.90, which is the 200-day moving average as drawn on the nearest futures chart. Next step would be a retest of 47, which has been our cycle low. After that, a 44 handle comes into play as potentially being the longer-term trend line support. And then 39.19 would be the final downside target that I see, which would be a retest of that low from all the way back in the beginning of August last summer. So, you know, I don't know how far it's going to get. I think at least the 200-day moving average is definitely in sight now. So that's a 48 handle. And we'll see what happens from here. And on the topic of oil, I was also interviewed this morning live on Houston Radio on the Lance Roberts Show. We're going to try to get a link to that interview into the Research Roundup. If anybody's curious on a little bit of an expanded oil wrap this week, you can find it there. Look for the link in the Research Roundup.
All right. Well, let's have a look at gold here. Now, I've been watching that 1300 level up above to see whether or not gold can muster up enough momentum to make a breakout above the 1300 round number. But so far, all we've seen is consolidation and even a little bit of selling with gold now just below that 1280 level. What's your feeling on gold here?
Well, we see that the dollar is bouncing here off of its key support. Gold is selling off. The big question in my mind is, does the dollar continue to bounce? Does that 99 key support continue to hold? And if it doesn't, if you were to see a sell-off that accelerates as everybody panics out of the long dollar trade, that could be an upside catalyst for gold. And obviously, a further escalation of geopolitical risk. I mean, obviously, if North Korea fires a nuclear warhead or something, that's going to, you know, dramatically increase the price of gold. But you've got to consider here that there's a lot of geopolitical risk already priced in. And statistically, the more likely outcome is the North Korean situation gets resolved without any nuclear wars, the Syrian situation gets de-escalated, and if that occurs, then I think a move back down to 1220, if not lower, is likely in the cards. So I don't think that you really want to be putting new money to work long in gold here unless you really believe that there's going to be an escalation of geopolitical tension. If you don't have that belief, then I think that the geopolitical premium that's already in gold needs to come back out before it's a buy. I definitely concede, though, that despite having seen that the bottom was going to happen at the December rate hike and having predicted that a month earlier, I didn't buy it at 1124 like I recommended to our listeners. So I definitely regret that. I'll be looking for an opportunity to get on the long side of the gold trade. But to me, it's not right here unless you think, which I don't, that there's going to be a dramatic geopolitical escalation.
All right, Eric, and I just wanted to now touch on the 10-year Treasury yields, and we've now seen them continue to work their way lower, edging toward the 220 handle on the downside. What's your feelings about where the yields are going next?
Well, as we predicted on this program, we took out 225 to the downside. I think 2% is the next psychological test. A lot of people think there's another important technical level at about 1.8%. I'm leaning towards the continued bull case in treasuries, meaning lower yields, higher prices. And one of the things that we've been talking about, you and I, off the air that I just want to let our listeners know, we've noticed that a lot of our guests have not really had a strong viewpoint on whether or not the bond bull market is over or not. So Patrick is working on booking a couple of guests who have a strong secular view about this situation that we have in fixed income. Hopefully we'll get a couple of strong and contrasting views in coming weeks so that you can get some expert guest commentary on this subject as well.
Well, great market insights, Eric. Now, let's move on to the interview. Danielle was an investment banker for 7 years and publicly predicted the housing crisis back in 2003. She went on to work at the Dallas Fed Research Department and has a lot to say about that experience. Eric's interview with Danielle is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me next on the program is noted author Danielle DiMartino Booth, who wrote, of course, the book Fed Up, which has gotten a lot of attention recently. Danielle, I read your book cover to cover this weekend, and I'm really glad that I did because, frankly, it's not about what I thought it was going to be about, and I found it much more interesting than I expected. I want to come back to that later, but I just want to share with you, reading the book just kept reminding me of this movie that I saw years and years ago. It was a documentary about the Space Shuttle Challenger disaster, and, of course, NASA party line was this was unforeseeable. It was just a horrible, unforeseeable, terrible disaster. As it turns out, there was actually an engineer who at every turn was trying to warn people, saying, look, there was badly scorched solid rocket boosters. There was blow-by past these O-rings. That clearly indicates that we have a flight risk problem. We need to do something. There's just one problem. This wasn't one of NASA's PhD scientists. This guy only had a master's degree. He was a lowly engineer, and they would not take him seriously. Danielle, you are that guy, but 20 years later at the Fed. And it's not O-rings this time. It's housing crisis. And it's amazing. It was amazing to me reading the book.
But before you jump in and before I forget the anecdote, I did get a second master's while I was still working on Wall Street at Columbia University. Now, forget the Columbia part. It was, to me, the best journalism school in the country, and I wanted to hone my writing skills for my retirement years. Well, I will tell you, one PhD walked up to me and said, well, at least your second master's is from Columbia, and you dress better than anybody else in the building. So I guess that makes you okay. And I sat there looking to him going, you're just a poster child for diversity or sensitivity or some kind of training, but they don't have PhD sensitivity training.
Well, and the thing that's amazing to me, your background to me is extremely impressive. You were an investment banker 7 years working on the street at DLJ, which at the time was one of the biggest investment banks on Wall Street before it was acquired. You had an excellent track record there, but then you went on to journalism and you were writing about your own prediction of a housing crisis being on the horizon going back to 2003. So you totally nailed it. You understood what was happening, why it was happening. You really had an amazing track record. You go get a job in research at the Dallas Fed. Now, for people who have never worked with academics before, a reasonable thinking person might assume that when you got there, there's a bunch of people with academic backgrounds and no real world experience. They ought to embrace you and say, Danielle, you've got all this real-world experience. We're so anxious to have you give us feedback on our models because we need to know how it relates to the real world. But that's not the culture that you encountered at the Dallas Fed in the research department. Tell us what it was like there.
Well, you know, it was very surprising to me the first time I was out on a trading floor in the middle of the day and you kind of smelled red meat, kind of raw red meat, and you felt this energy. And I only put that out there to contrast it with the library meets the morgue sensation that I got when I stepped into the Federal Reserve, bearing in mind there was nothing to offend the olfactory senses until you got close to the subsidized cafeteria where a lot of people spend a lot of their day. But inside the research department, bearing in mind I came in as house prices were peaking and rolling over and as the mortgage implometer, subprime mortgage. I mean, there was a website dedicated to blowing up subprime lenders as this thing was getting up and running and gaining a cult following. And I walked in and it was just kind of like another day. This just whistling past Dixie. Nothing going on here. Nothing to see. Extremely just it's genteel people going about their days trying to get published in prestigious journals.
It was amazing to me. You know, one of the things I remember going back to 2007 when I started reading and learning about the shadow banking system, which of course is the network of non-bank financial entities such as hedge funds, private equity firms, and so forth, that actually by 2007 had become bigger than the official banking system. And it's very complicated to get your head around, you know, what are the knock-on effects of rehypothecation of collateral in the tri-party repo system? I mean, holy cow, this is complicated stuff. And if you had asked me at that time, well, okay, who really is the grand expert who really understands how all this stuff works and how it fits together? I would have guessed that this army of PhD economists at the Fed would be the experts, because they're challenged with having to regulate and govern the global economy. I mean, in theory, the U.S. economy, but by extension, it really is the global economy. And it just shocked me to read this story in your book that the Fed literally didn't even know how the shadow banking system worked until almost by accident they hired this guy, Zoltan Pozsar. Tell us the story of how that happened and what he did and how that affected the Fed's understanding of the financial system.
Well, I can tell you that it was not Timothy Geithner onto whose radar screen happened Mr. Zoltan Pozsar, who became a good friend. It was more Bill Dudley coming from Goldman Sachs. So he kind of sort of understood the shadow banking system, because the firm that he had come from had its own warehouses and what have you off the balance sheet. Goldman Sachs, in many ways, has been the architect of a lot of the components of the shadow banking system over time. And I would say that they are also leaders in regulatory arbitrage, in other words, in making sure that the way they conduct finance and the way they engineer the financial system is incapable of being comprehended by regulators. So it was Bill Dudley who found Pozsar, but even he hadn't been able to connect all of the dots, if you will, that Pozsar had. And we laugh that our backgrounds were both in finance, but that neither of us were PhDs. But he came to be a very crucial individual in the aftermath of the crisis, mind you, because he was able to build out the liquidity lines that had frozen up during the crisis. In other words, he was on the ground. He was liquid plumber. And it wasn't, as we were arguing to Bernanke at the time, which was falling on deaf ears, you're giving the patient the wrong medicine. It's not the level of interest rates. It's that liquidity is frozen between investors and between the borrowers. We need to unfreeze these lines. And it was Pozsar's map that helped them understand where these lines had frozen up in between the conventional and shadow banking systems in the middle of this subprime bubble that later became the subprime crisis.
Well, it comes as no surprise to me that this one guy, Pozsar, who actually had real experience on the street as opposed to just an academic background, maybe he didn't have a PhD, but he was the guy who actually brought some reality to the Fed, as you describe, and helped them to understand what was important. So please tell me 5 years later that this guy now has moved on and occupies a position of great higher responsibility at the Fed.
No, actually, he was told in no uncertain terms that he needed to pass along his data and research to the doctors and give it up and let them do the important work. And he needed to stay on the desk doing the work of the busybodies, at which point he said no. And now the Credit Suisse.
So it sounds like the Fed's culture is basically a bunch of academics that have never had a real job. And when they get somebody who comes in and shows them up, who actually knows what they're doing and understand how the system really works. And for our registered users at macrovoices.com, Mr. Pozsar wrote a fantastic paper while he was at the Fed in 2010. We have a link to that in your research roundup email, which I recommend reading. This guy who can really pull it all together, instead of being rewarded as the guy who helped them to understand what was really important as opposed to their academic models, he basically gets pushed out of the organization in recognition for his contribution. It's just an amazing story.
Hard to believe. Absolutely.
I want to move on to another thing Speaking of hard to believe, that just blew my mind. I think everybody listening to this program knows that in finance, FOMC days are probably the biggest event in terms of data, bigger than non-farm payroll or GDP, is that 2 p.m. on a Wednesday when the FOMC statement comes out every 6 weeks or so. And every single trading floor, everything stops. Every eye is glued to that TV set at 1 second before 2 p.m. Liquidity literally dries up in the market because nobody wants to have orders open until they can hear those crucial words that are going to be so important. Now, considering that the Fed staff does not get any pre-briefing, only the people on the FOMC know what the statement is going to say when it's released. Again, a thinking person might conclude, if they had never worked with academics before, that the people inside the Fed would be even more excited to see what the next FOMC statement is because it's going to affect their work in terms of briefing the FOMC members for the next meeting coming up. So it just blew my mind, Danielle. In your book, you described that at the Dallas Fed where you worked, there are only two TV sets in the building. One in the president's office, the other one was in the coffee room. And on FOMC days, you had to go to the coffee room to find out what the FOMC outcome was, and you were the only one there. All of these other people in the research department apparently didn't think it worth their time to go watch the FOMC statement come out live. That just blows my mind. So what are these people doing at the Fed if they're not interested, like the rest of us are, in these FOMC statements that have so much effect on markets?
Well, you know, what they're doing is truly working on a lot of what they worked on when they got their PhDs. And it is, let's say that there are, call it 30 PhDs in any given research department. Well, they are assigned a briefing maybe 2-3 at the outside times a year where they're actually preparing a briefing for the president to take with them to the FOMC meeting. Other than that, they really are working on expanding their body of knowledge, many times which has to do with what the topic of their dissertation and getting published in the next prestigious publication of economics. The way that the pre-brief, so to speak, this was the briefing made to others in the research department, started was by the director of research rewarding those who'd had their papers accepted into these publications with a bottle of wine. And everybody would clap politely and enviously because, oh boy, they got into that one. But that was one of, you know, when I spoke to people at the Fed who had left the Fed, one of the pragmatists, if you will, main regrets was the inability to turn the research department into more of a machine that produced output specifically for matters that were pertinent to the FOMC. Now, you may think that I have just said a lot of gobbledygook nothing, but concentrate on what I just said. Matters that were pertinent to people setting interest rate policy. That was one of his lifetime regrets after 40 years on the inside. Was that he hadn't been able to turn his machine into something that was a little bit more pragmatic and applicable to the real world.
I remember in the wake of the 2008 crisis, we had a whole alphabet soup of government programs from TARP to a whole bunch of other ones. One that really stuck out in my mind and you wrote about in the book was TSLF. And I don't remember what it actually stands for because I always called it Treasury's Lent for Toxins, where basically you've got a whole bunch of worthless securities because you took crazy risks and the government, or the Fed, I should say, decides to directly bail out Wall Street, unelected Fed officials decide that they're going to bail out Wall Street by allowing them to essentially swap this worthless paper for treasuries. And that was very criticized in the blogosphere at the time. I was absolutely fuming mad about it. I thought it was immoral. So I'm really curious, what's the attitude inside the Fed? Did people that were working for the Fed at that time feel like they were a party to doing something that was selling out the country to bail out Wall Street? Or did they not see it as a wrongdoing at all?
Well, bear in mind, you're talking about decisions that are really made at the New York Fed and in Washington, D.C., and these are the places that were considered to be the authorities within the broader organization And in terms of the politics of it and the optics of it and whether or not it was right, wrong, or in between, it was just the way things were done. And, you know, if you look back, so much of this has been made money good in terms of there not being any losses incurred for taking on the risk of holding that paper. But that's neither here nor there. I think that that is more a reflection of the fact that the Fed made it plain that through recurring iterations of quantitative easing, that it would make sure that none of these markets collapsed. And that, in fact, people who came in as scavengers, if you will, into these markets made a ton of money in the aftermath. But to your point, I don't think that the Fed, when you listen to Janet Yellen on TV say, "Oh, we're not political," I dare say quite a few of them believe what they're saying, which is so amazing to me, given just the prima facie evidence that they're anything but an apolitical institution.
Well, and along those same lines, something that really struck out to me, I didn't know until reading your book that your boss at the Dallas Fed was actually one of the only people on the FOMC who thought that there needed to be some equivalent to insider trading rules. And what blows my mind, Danielle, if I understand this correctly, if Janet Yellen tomorrow called Lloyd Blankfein at Goldman Sachs and said, "Hey, listen, got a secret for you. We're going to go with QE4 starting at the next meeting. Nobody knows about it. Go ahead and front run it, and then you can give me a better job when I don't get reappointed by President Trump when my term is up." Obviously, if she did such a thing, and I don't think Janet would ever do that, but if hypothetically she did, she'd be selling out the entire country so that Goldman could make billions. If that happened, would anybody have violated any law that's actually on the books right now?
A law that's on the books. Well, something that you just described would certainly be...
Because I don't think it would. I think that's actually legal.
Well, what you describe is actually illegal. However, the ability for Federal Reserve policymakers to meet with those in the private sector has not been reined in. And I think we saw evidence of that with a recent Brookings Institution private audience with the vice chair, Stanley Fischer. And some of the people who sat on that board are members of some of the largest shadow banking entities on planet Earth. The Fed, I think, would be convicted if what you described actually occurred. But I think that opportunities for there to be leaks, and if we've learned anything from Lacker and his assertion that he was simply the corroborator and not the source of the leak, if we've learned anything, it is that the culture and the environment is such that leaders within the Federal Reserve don't feel that it is that there's a conflict of interest involved in having private audiences with those who can benefit the most profit-wise. So that's a problem. That is a problem, and it is a problem that has not been addressed. It shook me to my bones when Daniel Tarullo, in his last few days at the Fed, in his capacity, bear in mind, of a lawyer, but it shook me to my bones that Tarullo said that the Lacker matter had been resolved properly and legally, and that it was that the matter itself was going to be put to rest. That was highly unsatisfactory for me. And I don't even think we should audit the Fed. I'm not even in that camp.
Why don't we talk then about what we should do? Because obviously, you know, Ron Paul, the libertarian from Texas, your state, has tried unsuccessfully to mount campaigns to end the Fed or to audit the Fed. I think you don't agree that those are the right solutions. So what is the right solution? What needs to happen in order to rein this organization in and make it accountable to the best interests of the country?
Well, there are a lot of things we can do. You know, you discussed something that was that could be very elegantly satisfied by bringing Glass-Steagall back. I know people hate to hear that, but you know, if you're going to bring deposits in and have the social safety, and it is, and have the commercial safety net of the U.S. government under you, don't take the taxpayers' money to Vegas and borrow and play with it and speculate with it. Keep the investment banking activities outside of anything that will ever touch the taxpayers' purse. Slice the dual mandate that was doubled in 1977 back in half. Leave private leave job creation in the hands of the private sector. In the times of recession, if we need to extend unemployment benefits, maybe once, fine. Then Congress can step in times of emergency. But otherwise, the Fed does not have the correct tools to address the labor market. It is what's caused mission creep within the institution. Remove that from the Federal Reserve and leave them simply with safeguarding the buying power of the U.S. dollar, period, end. And I mentioned earlier the fact that there are power seats in Washington, D.C. and at the New York Fed. I would argue that those need to be distilled and dispersed throughout the country, and that the original lines drawn in 1913 of the 12 Federal Reserve districts be readdressed, that three of them that are in the Midwest vanish because they're no longer economically relevant, and that you add one on the West Coast, because clearly Janet Yellen's San Francisco Federal Reserve during the years of the buildup to the housing bubble, there wasn't enough in the way of eyes, ears, on the ground supervision, regulation. You'll end up with 10 Federal Reserve districts, give all permanent votes, and make sure then that you slash the number of PhDs and you bring in more people who are on the receiving end of Fed policy, who don't have an agenda, who aren't beholden to Keynes or some other economic school of thought, and who can come in and help you make much more pragmatic policy decisions going forward. That's just my short list.
That's the short list, and I'll just point out for our listeners that the entire last chapter of your book is the long list, and I really found it quite enlightening. I want to move on now, though, to some of the knock-on consequences of what's happened here, because I hear so much talk about rate normalization, and everybody's saying, oh, we're just about to begin returning to historically normal Treasury yields. And I just think, wait a minute. If you look where we are now on the 10-year yield, you'd have to double or triple it in order to get back to historically normal yields. That, by definition, means you would have to double or triple the cost of borrowing for the U.S. government to finance its operations. And now that we're at $20 trillion of debt, half of it having been created after the financial crisis, if we went back to a 10-year yield of 6% plus, it would bankrupt the federal government. So my contention is we're stuck here because the government cannot afford to do what it claims it wants to do, which is to normalize rates. Am I right to think that the Fed has basically boxed us into a liquidity trap where we're going to be stuck with economic stagnation and super low interest rates for many years to come? Or have I missed something here?
I think you're spot on. I think that you speak to the crime, if you will, and I don't use that word lightly, the crime of a bunch of doctors who cannot write prescriptions, thinking that they know how to solve the world's problems and imposing themselves upon our economy as they have in the form of low interest rates, has not only left our government vulnerable to rising interest rates and made it such that we can never have rising interest rates, it has committed the same exact crime against U.S. households and corporations. All entities, all three of those, depend on interest rates never being normalized.
And this just leads me to the next thing, which I think is literally the biggest story of our lifetimes, which is, you know, a lot of people would say, well, the big financial story was the Great Depression of the 1930s, and the next story after that was the great financial crisis of 2008. I don't think 2008 was the story. I think the pension crisis of the 2020s and 30s that hasn't happened yet, which you write about in the book, that is, to me, where I think the biggest story of our lives is going to come in. And I just think, you know, how many people on the street, how many lay people understand that they're upset about the bailout of the Wall Street banks because they think it was unfair, but how many of them understand that the price that we paid for that is that pension systems globally are undercapitalized to the tune of at least $75 trillion? Lawrence Kotlikoff's research says that in the United States, the total fiscal gap, if you include unfunded liabilities like Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security, is $202 trillion, 10 times the size of the national debt. If we agree, Danielle, that rates are stuck low for a long time, I don't see any possible way that could lead to anything other than a massive pension crisis in our lifetimes, in the next, you know, 10 to 15 years. I don't think hardly anybody comprehends that's the price that we have yet to pay, but we're about to pay. How many of the hardworking firemen and policemen and factory workers who have been told the strongest social contract that we have in civilized society is this promise of a pension? You work hard all your life. There's these really, really smart finance guys. Some of them have PhDs, and they've been entrusted to design and run this system that guarantees you financial stability in your retirement. Guess what? They're not going to see that money. It ain't going to happen. And it ain't going to happen because of what the Fed has done. Am I out of my mind to think that it's that extreme?
No, you're not. And you don't even describe a situation that is necessarily just American. I won't go off on this tangent, but the Minister of Finance of Germany informed Mario Draghi that if he insisted on maintaining his low interest rate policy, that German life insurance companies would start to go under beginning in 2018. I think we refer to that as next year. You know, every single time I write about pensions, and I write every single week for my blog, but every time I write about pensions, I'm amazed at the hand-to-hand combat that breaks out in my comments section, because you've got somebody whose wife was a teacher for her entire career, and she has two master's degrees, and she retired after a lifetime of hard work, and by golly, that pension is something that she earned and legally deserves. And then you've got somebody on the other side who says, but I'm having to pick up my family and leave this state because my property taxes in my retirement years have become so onerous that I can no longer afford to live here because they keep raising my property taxes to top off the pension system. Guess what? Both of those people commenting on my feed are absolutely correct. They're both in their rights in terms of being outraged. And it's not just in response to Federal Reserve policy, but it's also in response to people who were corrupt in terms of backing these pensions, politicians, the people, the unions, et cetera. It took two to tango, but it was years and years ago inside of the Federal Reserve. I had lunch with Richard Fisher, and it was when there were riots in the streets of Athens, and it just happened to be when he and I were having lunch to celebrate my 40th birthday. This is years ago. I said, "What is your greatest fear in your lifetime that you will see?" And he said, "I fear that we will see those riots in our streets." And that got us on a discussion about the pension system. It's a huge problem that nobody wants to talk about. They prefer to think that Meredith Whitney made a bad prediction a few years ago on 60 Minutes and that it didn't come to fruition inside of 12 months' time, and ergo, we don't need to talk about it anymore. And let's be polite. That is not the case. The pension situation is not going to go away. It's going to end up being a federal issue. Not that anybody wants that to be the case, but it's going to end up being an issue for federal taxpayers.
Well, and you say next year, it's already happening in your state of Texas this year, where you have public employee pensions that are in just disastrous, crazy situations. What has to happen next, Danielle? Because, I mean, as much as I enjoyed your book, I don't think that the masses of everyday Americans are going to be reading a book about the Federal Reserve. Do we need a movie along the lines of The Big Short that says, hey, did you know you're never going to see your pension and it's the Fed's fault and we need reform and we need people to pay attention to this? What needs to happen in society in order for these wrongs to be corrected? Because I think we're headed in the 2020s for a massive crisis. And the thing is, when we get to that point, it's not like the federal government can just say, hey, we'll bail everybody out. They don't have enough money to bail everything out. And eventually you get to the point where, as far as I'm concerned, we're already at a point where $20 trillion of national debt, that can never, ever be repaid in real terms. It can be paid in nominal terms if you inflate away the purchasing power, but you can never repay that, and it would only get worse. And I think that if you tried to have a government bailout of all of the pension systems that are going to fail in the next 10 years, it would result in the dollar losing its reserve currency status and a massive treasury crisis. So is it really as bad as I think? And more importantly, what do we as a society need to do in order to fix the wrongs that have already occurred? Is it recoverable at this point? And what needs to happen next?
You know, these are just impossible questions to answer. As bad as the situation is going to be for public pensions, individuals who have their retirement savings in 401k plans and haven't been able to get any return on their cash, they're also going to get hit by the same exact series of events that hit pensions. So it's in terms of where will we be able to find relief, you know, I'm, all four of my children take Mandarin because I'm concerned that the problem is going to become global, that you won't, everybody won't be able to inflate away their debts nicely and elegantly, and that you will end up with something beyond a currency war in terms of potentially a real war, because who's going to end up having enough money to address the situation, especially if you look forward a few years down the line and consider the Chinese are in the process of working through their foreign reserves. So who's going to be stepping up to our auctions when these things occur, to our treasury auctions, as these things are culminating? And at some point you have to consider the possibility that our reserve currency status does not hold.
And I would definitely agree with that. I think the only reason it has held this long is because there is thus far no viable alternative to U.S. treasuries as central bank reserve assets. But boy, folks like Sergei Glazyev in Russia and the Chinese are working pretty hard to solve that problem. And they see it as a problem. They think that we need for the world to have alternatives to the U.S. dollar as a reserve currency. And I'm very curious to hear your view. If you accept my argument that you can never repay the national debt in real terms, you can only pay it back by debasing the currency, doesn't that mean that if we're at all-time high prices and low yields, that really doesn't make any sense, that you're paying top dollar for some loan that can never be repaid? And you kind of beat me to the punch on this one. If you look at what history teaches us about this, when you have a situation where governments cannot possibly bail situations out, the solution that actually works, if you want to consider it a success, is going to war. So are we headed for a global sovereign debt crisis that leads to a global, you know, military confrontation? Is it really that bad? I think it could be. I don't think it's a dire, oh my gosh, this is going to happen tomorrow prediction. But I think in the next 10 to 20 years, we could be looking at a global military conflict that results from the fact that there is no solid sovereign debt or reserve asset. If somebody doesn't replace the dollar, what would be the reserve asset? How would the global financial system continue to function? Or would the international monetary system collapse in some kind of global sovereign debt crisis? Are these ideas just too crazy to be real? Or am I onto something that could actually happen?
Well, I think that one of the reasons that China, there was a very informative story about China's trilemma, so to speak. You know, they're trying to manipulate their currency at the same time that they're trying to modernize capital flows, and they can't have everything at the same time. But a lot of the reasons that they were trying to modernize was to have the yuan accepted into a basket of four currencies. Well, if you look at who's inside the basket, basically, you're talking about United States, Europe, Russia, and China. And if you want to talk about the longest continuous border in the world, that would be that between Russia and China. And my greatest concern is the yuan is nowhere near the status where it could potentially replace the dollar. But things happen really fast. If you're the country with a few trillion dollars extra set aside versus the country that is not. If these things were to come to fruition, at least China has put themselves in the position to potentially be part of the basket and or take the dollar out as the reserve currency. You know, if you speak to textbook economists, the kind who love me so much that they've all taken me off their Christmas card list. Okay, I was never on them. But if you listen to them, there's going to be a sweet gentleman's agreement whereby all of the debt is formally monetized and goes away. I can't see that happening. I can't see our enemies allowing that to happen and for us to walk away with reserve currency status peacefully. Just don't see it. And by that same token, you know, until there's an alternative or some kind of an event that throws things, and I think that that will be the next recession in the United States that gets the ball rolling. But until that happens, all that markets reflect right now, with interest rates still at ridiculously low levels, is the lack of alternatives. But it doesn't reflect what the end game could potentially be.
So do you think that that means that there is a U.S. Treasury bond crisis that is on the horizon, but it doesn't, the catalyst that causes it to happen is the emergence of an alternative that doesn't exist yet? Is that a correct interpretation of your last comment?
I think so. I think that Bitcoin is not viable per se, but I do think that its emergence is a reflection of global distress in the dollar's prospects to be able to retain its reserve currency status, given the behavior of our politicians, given the lack of behavior among our politicians to address what's to come.
What would your guess be, Danielle, if you had to speculate as to what will eventually emerge to replace the U.S. dollar as the world's reserve asset, as the world's reserve currency? Is it the currency of another nation, or is it an innovation along the lines of Bitcoin that ends up doing that? How do you see this playing out?
Oh, gosh, you know, you're talking about the ultimate crystal ball, and I wish I could help you out, because I don't understand cryptocurrency. I don't understand Bitcoin. I've got some real crazies on my Twitter feed who have tried to explain it to me, even though I don't want to have it explained to me. And I just cannot say, I cannot envision a world in which there's not a superpower, because we just live in an alpha. We live in an alpha world where whoever prevails is the one whose currency gets to be it. And it was British pound sterling at a time when Britain was a colonial nation and controlled most of planet Earth. And as things stand today, at least economically speaking, we control most of planet Earth, judged by the amount of global payments that occur in dollars. I cannot envision some kind of a Bitcoin successor coming about. I don't see sovereigns behaving that way. I see sovereigns behaving as one is dominant and the others are subservient in some way at some level.
Well, I would love to go on for another hour talking to you about the potential knock-on effects. To me, it's just an absolutely fascinating subject, but unfortunately, we are running out of time. Before we close, I just want to share with our listeners my experience with your book. I made the wrong assumption about what it was going to be about. I thought it was going to be a tutorial to help the layperson understand the mechanics of monetary policy and what the conventional tools are and how quantitative easing works and how it's different and so forth. And I kind of thought, you know, I'm pretty knowledgeable about that already. I'm probably not going to learn very much from reading this book. My experience was the exact opposite, Danielle. The way I want our listeners to think about this, you remember, if you've been in this market for a while, the 2007 and 8 event, you remember the monetary policy response with initial accommodation, eventually getting to the zero bound into QE and Operation Twist and so forth. This really is an insider's diary telling that whole story, exposing the politics and the culture of the Fed and how dysfunctional so many aspects of it are. And I think that even people who are expert at monetary policy and so forth, who are not insiders, will gain a lot of insight into how things really work in this organization that so many people put on a pedestal and think is just so all-knowing about all things. And it's simply not true, and you do a fantastic job of telling the story. So the book is Fed Up by Danielle DiMartino Booth, but I know a lot of our listeners are going to want to follow your work even more closely than that. So what's on your website? What other writing do you do besides the book? Where can people learn more about you and what you do?
Well, please, I invite you to come onto my website, demartinobooth.com. Follow me on Twitter at demartinobooth. You will not be unhappy. I promise I don't waste anybody's time on Twitter. And follow my weekly, sign up for my, subscribe to my weekly, and you can also go on Bloomberg. I'm one of their new prophets, P-R-O-P-H-E-T-S. So I write a weekly commentary for Bloomberg as well. And I think you'll find that I have opinions on all sorts of things They're all grounded, though, in that near decade I spent on the inside of the Federal Reserve and how that has definitely changed the way I see the world.
Well, I cannot thank you enough for a fantastic interview, Danielle, and I definitely recommend the book to our listeners. Patrick Serezna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Eric, what a great interview with Danielle. I really thought her behind-the-curtain look on how operations run in those regional reserve banks was really insightful. What were your thoughts on the interview?
I really enjoyed it, and I enjoyed reading the book, and it confirms a lot of what I've always thought. You know, so many people just idolize the Fed as if, well, they are the gods of the universe and they know everything. They certainly are the gods of the universe in the sense that they have the power to influence everything more than anybody else. But at the end of the day, it's another government bureaucracy. And it sounds like Danielle has confirmed what I've always thought, which is that they really don't have their act together very well on the inside. But what I want to do now is shift gears, because we have been talking about options on our last several shows. We wanted to move on this week to talk about the macro approach and macro analysis. I know that you have a course at bigpicturetrading.com that's entirely about fundamental analysis with a macro focus. And it really got me to thinking, Patrick, about how I would do that, because, you know, I run a fund that has a macro focus. But if I were to try to explain to somebody precisely what it is I do, or a step-by-step about how to do it, I don't even know where I would start. So why don't we start with, how do you frame this? Where does macro fit into an overall investment strategy? And what do you teach people about how to think about fitting macro in with other types of analysis in order to be effective traders?
Well, you know, Eric, I went through a lot of different experiences in the almost 20 years that I've been in this industry. And I've done everything from a pure focus on technical analysis to the idea of looking at all the different fundamentals within all the different corporations. But then ultimately it dawned on me of understanding why these major macro trends occur. So, you know, through time, I developed into the view that the macro fundamentals are actually like the center of the universe, right? They drive almost every trend that exists. They kind of drive the market conditions, which influence the corporate fundamentals of the balance sheets of the companies, which then technically manifest themselves in the charts. And so it's about taking a holistic view of seeing how this all interconnects. Now, if you take someone that's in this industry and they just use technical analysis, well, that's okay, but it's just focusing on one facet, and that's the liquidity. And yeah, you can trade around that directly, but it isn't holistic in its view. And same with the idea of corporate fundamentals. You can kind of look at the management, its balance sheet, its earnings trends, and all these things. But again, it doesn't look at what are the drivers and the business cycle and all these other things that are going to turn this all eventually down the road. And so it's always about trying to look at in that big picture, top-down approach, and seeing what are going to be the things that are going to be driving it 3 or 6 months down the road, not just what's happening right now.
Well, of course, the menu that you might choose from of what things might be driving the market is a huge menu. So how do you approach this? Is there a list that you have of macro indicators that you follow or that you teach people about? You know, what's first? How do I enter this world of macro analysis if I don't have experience with it?
Right. Well, to me, it always begins with the analysis of currency. Currencies are the lifeblood of economies, and the strength or weakness of any one currency influences a country's economic growth, its balance of trade, its capital inflow or outflow, the management of its foreign debts. And so as the currencies are moving, they have a direct influence on everything else. And one of the most direct influences is the relationship of the U.S. dollar, which is this global international national currency of trade. You know, some people believe that that will eventually change and that we're going through the transformation. But at this stage, the vast majority of global trade still is conducted in U.S. dollars. And because of that, there's this natural intermarket inverse relationship of the dollar to that of commodities. And so as you have these major trends in these currencies emerging, they're directly influencing commodity trends. And both currencies and commodities have a very big input variable to inflation trends. And this is where central banks play a very key role, because they're trying to smooth out this process. They're trying to either open the faucet and let more liquidity in, or shut off the faucet, slow things down. And they're trying to step on the pedal or the brakes to try to hit this mythical number of a 2% inflation target that almost every central bank in the world seems to have chosen as their kind of benchmark target. But these central banks are trying to intervene in that way. And so it's about understanding what the goal of the central bank is into influencing those currencies and the subsequent consequences of that. And obviously the central banks, the predominant intervention is in the bond markets. I mean, beyond Kuroda in Japan, who interferes in the equity and REIT markets, most central bankers simply are influencing interest rates on the short term and through things like quantitative easing or yield curve control. They're trying to manipulate interest rates in the middle to long end of the yield curves. Nonetheless, the influence and of the trend in the bond markets is incredibly important, because that determines the ultimate cost of credit, the cost of who's most creditworthy. You know, the bond market is determining ultimately what people have to pay for interest. And this is important because it has a very natural influence to real estate. You know, while there's all sorts of these additional variables that influence real estate, such as demographics or regional trends and foreign capital and things like this, but generally, two of the largest influences are direction of interest rates, which influence mortgage rates, and the health of the banking system in terms of making credit readily available to the real estate markets. And they tend to drive the real estate prices, which is very important for that broader wealth effect. There's no one asset class that has the broadest wealth effect in real estate, because so many people own it. And the key takeaway from all of this is that each of these markets, whether you're talking currencies, commodities, bonds, or real estate, they're all very large and influential. But what I find is so many people just focus on stocks, and all they care about is whether the stock market is up or it's down. But they don't spend enough time understanding how these other big, huge markets are influencing it. And so my view is sort of taking this top-down approach of trying to understand all of this, putting it all together, and seeing how that influences the stock story.
So if I summarize that, you're basically telling people they need to learn how to construct a worldview that's influenced by first understanding currencies and what they mean and what their relationships tell you, understanding central bank policy and what the central bankers are trying to accomplish, understanding inflation, understanding interest rates and the factors that drive interest rates and the signals that the fixed income market is giving us, so that we know what does it mean when we're seeing a big move down in treasury yields as we're seeing right now. And then the follow-on to that is seeing the connection between interest rates and the knock-on effects that it has on the real estate market, which is so sensitive, of course, to mortgage rates. That all sounds great, but you know, when I was learning about all this stuff, I very quickly got to the point where I had opinions on all these things, and I could be interesting in a cocktail party conversation to talk about this stuff. But unlike the stock market, where you've got some pretty clear criteria, you know, is a stock undervalued or overvalued? Well, how do you tell? You look at its P/E ratio. When you say, is the dollar index undervalued or overvalued? You know, there's no P/E ratio for the dollar index. So how do you take this sort of big picture of the world and interconnections that are happening in global markets, this view that you form, and translate that into actionable specific trades that you would put on?
Right. Well, this is the tricky part about macro, and this is why a lot of people tend not to overly focus on it, is because it doesn't immediately translate into an immediate opportunity, or often the timing is way off, right? And that's largely because macro fundamentals can only ever tell you the what is going to happen and why it's going to happen. And while you can understand what and the why, it very rarely does a good job of explaining when is it going to happen and where is it going to go. And being able to answer the when and the where is often not being given to you by just studying the storyline there. And so the when and where, this is where we turn to technical analysis and the study of liquidity within the marketplace. And that's where in that live auction, buyers and sellers are voting with their money. And you can see that in the way the price behaves and the things it does. And so this is where you have to bridge the technical analysis with that macro fundamentals.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. The way that I describe my own trading approach is everything is driven by the macro in terms of understanding what do I want to trade, what bets do I want to be in. Everything about the timing of when to get in or out of a position is entirely driven by technical analysis, because without technical analysis, how do you know whether, you know, a currency pair or the dollar index or, you know, something is over or undervalued? You have to have some kind of driving force telling you what to do. And so it sounds like a very compatible approach. What I want to do now, though, is put that to work. Let's look at today's interview, and I want to make this a theme for future shows as well. Let's take the discussion that we had with the guest in the interview and then apply your macro approach to it and talk about how you would translate some of those views into trades. So what Danielle had to say today was essentially that we can expect, as long as Janet Yellen is at the helm at the Fed, we're going to continue to see very accommodative policy. There will probably be more accommodation and eventually more quantitative easing in the next recession. It seems like everything the Fed is doing to hike rates is just giving themselves room to lower them later. So we know they're coming back down. So you probably can have a view there that rates are going to come back down in the future, even after this hiking cycle completes. We also know that she has a view that all of this is setting us up for a massive, massive long-term liquidity trap where we get stuck with low interest rates and where the national debt becomes unserviceable in real terms. That basically means they're going to have to create more inflation in order to tame the massive size of the debt. So if those are Danielle's views, you know, that doesn't sound like something I can type into my online broker and put a trade on. How do you take views like that and translate them to something actionable?
Well, I think the most obvious thing is that it puts to question whether or not the entire reflation narrative has any merit. Obviously, the reflation trade has really worked well for the latter part of 2016. It certainly hasn't been working at all this year. And a lot of money has been made on this whole idea of being short bonds, long high beta, high, so many of these cyclical names that have been making so much money. But if there's any merit to that scenario, then it may very well prove that this entire reflation trade may prove to once again be early. If you kind of look at it in the bigger context, over the last decade, I guess not decade, but less 7-8 years, since maybe 2010, there have been a lot of bond bears. And one of the greatest obsessions is trying to call the top of this 35-year bond bull market. And whether you go back to 2010, when it was the great rotation, to almost every single one, everything from tapering to everyone was just calling the top of the bond market, top of the bond market. And over again, they've been calling it and they were wrong every single time. And this massive secular downtrend of interest rates remains intact. You know, and how many times that you've seen over the last 20 years where that same storyline has happened in Japan. So the question really is that if in fact this big surge in inflation and growth doesn't materialize and we see much lower nominal growth rates, much lower nominal inflation rates than what everyone was anticipating, it is going to allow the yields, particularly in the middle to the long end of the yield curve, to continue to gravitate lower in what will be a flattening curve trade. Now, we have some very sophisticated listeners and know how to actually trade the curve flattener. But if you're just a straightforward investor and you just want to position yourself in this, you know, you really at this stage, after this bloodbath in the bond markets and the government bond markets, because, you know, we never really saw a sell-off in high yield junk or anything like this. And so you had the bloodbath occur in that the 10 and 30 year treasury bonds, where the TLT goes from $145 down to the $117, $18 lows on the downside. But maybe there isn't a big bond bear market underway. Maybe we are going to see this continue to be a secular period of low interest rates, which probably makes this an incredibly compelling buy low opportunity, you know, as everyone was caught way too short bonds here. So, you know, to me, I don't know. I just think that that there's a trade opportunity there. Now, what I always like to do is create asymmetry in this with options. You know, like for instance, if you have a Gunlatch scenario, like Gunlatch built a narrative where, you know, there could be still one more leg that goes to 3% yields on the 10-year later in the year. There's always a chance that that kind of scenario can happen. So how do you manage the risk in that scenario? What if you're early to the trade? And this is where I love options, is that there's an asymmetry to it where I can take a very decisive position. If I'm wrong, my risk is very much contained to the cost of the option. But if I'm right, I'm able to keep going with that trend. Even if I run out of time, I can roll it forward. I can exercise, take the underlying. There's so many different things you can do. And you're using that option as a risk management tool rather than over analyzing the short-term technicals of, you know, where my stop loss, I got nicked out. Do I get back in, and all of the complexity that comes with trying to short-term time things rather than play the bigger picture.
Well, speaking of being out of time, we are in fact out of time. I was hoping to get, I know that you teach 5 tenets of macro in your course. I was hoping to ask you about that this week. We're going to have to save that for next week. But we will continue, folks, with this approach of trying to apply some of what Patrick teaches to translating the views of our guests into how you might trade those ideas. Let us know if you like that idea. We've gotten a little bit of feedback suggesting that might be a welcome change, and we certainly appreciate your comments. Please also keep your suggestions for topics, for guests, and so forth coming to requests@macrovoices.com. Be sure to check out Patrick's website at bigpicturetrading.com, where he offers a whole number of different courses, online education, teaching people how to be traders. Beyond that, you've heard it before, but I've got to say it again, we really need your help promoting the show, because the more registered users we have at macrovoices.com, the more able we are to get really, really good guests. We've got a heavy hitter coming up next week that Patrick was able to recruit, one of our most requested ever, and we're going to keep doing that. But we need you to please help us by retweeting when we announce the show, forward your research roundup email to your friends and colleagues so they see what they're missing, and most importantly, register your free account at macrovoices.com. The benefit to you is that you will receive the research roundup, which is an email, never has advertising or marketing. It's just a compendium of links to all the coolest stuff that we could find on the internet that week. Patrick, tell them what we have this week in the research roundup.
Yeah, so this week what our listeners will find inside that email will be the transcript link for today's interview with Danielle. In addition to that, you'll find that link that you were referencing for the New York Fed report on the shadow banking system. As well, there's a link for an article that Jeffrey Snyder wrote, Assessing China's Economic Risks. And there are also several links discussing the European elections, everything from the insights to the French elections to the new UK snap election. You'll find this and so much more in this week's research roundup. So that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. For those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, please send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we'll include it in our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account, at Macro Voices, for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric directly on Twitter, at Eric S. Townsend. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the Internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.